Okay, ladies and ladies, it is time for us to learn some Torah. And as I said to you, please excuse me if the quality is a little less than normal, but my brain is a little bit confused, having not had any sleep and flown across the water. Therefore, we will try and make sense of what we can. There are two things that I want to try and do today. They are the following. To try and work out what were the Savurayim, who were the Savurayim, this mysterious group of people that appear after the Gemara, and try and get a little bit of a handle on who they were. And then also to give you a broad historical update on the period up until the beginning of the Rishonim. Meaning, I'm not spending a large amount of time on this period of history, although, because from a Torah point of view, there's not that much that needs to be discussed. The period of the Gaonim is a little bit of a black hole, a little bit of a dark ages. Not dark ages in the sense that there were, you know, Vikings running around and killing people, but dark ages in the sense that it wasn't really a time of enormous dynamism in terms of Torah development, although we'll see some important things happen. I really want to get up to the issue of the Rishonim, and from next time, which will be Sunday, because Thursday is a bit of a funny old day, Rosh Chodesh Adar and all that, from Sunday really, I want to really take us from, this is my plan, from Sunday through to the end of the semester, end of the Pesach, not the end of the semester, I want to really overview completely the Rishonim, understand their methodology, understand what they're trying to do, so you can really get a handle on the key people that you learn day in, day out. Rashi, Tosfos, the Rambam, the Spanish school of the Ramban and the Rashba and the Ritva, the impact of the Black Death on the whole Rishonim and Torah process. I really want to cover that up until the end of Adar. Then, what next semester, not next semester, but you know what I mean, from the, when we come back to Pesach till the end of the year, I want to look really in depth at the issue of halachic psak. What is psak? What was the Shulchan Aruch? What was it for? Why was it written? What is a psak today? Who is a rav? How do you ask a shaila? Can you go to different people for different shailas? Do you have to be a man to answer a shaila? What about women rabbis? All sorts of issues that can halakha change, and how does psak change with the circumstances, modern technology, all of those questions, which is really, I want to deal with that after Pesach. Okay? But for now, we have a little bit of historical ground to cover, otherwise you won't understand the context. So, with that introduction, let's look at these three brief sources. Look at number one, two, and three. So, first of all, number one, you see me for Rav Ashi v'Ravina Soif Hora'ah. So Rav Ashi and Ravina, who lived in the late 400s, they were the end of Hora'ah. Now, literally, what does Hora'ah mean? Teaching, instruction. Hora'ah is an instruction. Hora'ah are instructions. Okay? They were the end of the instructions, whatever that means. Okay? Look at Rav Shriruga number two. Ubasar Hachi, this is just one line from a longer piece of Rosh Hashanah that I'm going to point to in a minute. Ubasar Hachi, after that, after Rav Ashi and Ravina, Afal Gav de Vadai Hora'ah lo havat. There wasn't Hora'ah anymore. There wasn't Hora'ah, in terms of whatever that means, teaching, we'll define it soon. Nevertheless, Havu Savurai. There were Savurai. Now, what is Savurai? So there's some kind of Japanese, the martial arts thing. Savurai. Okay, maybe only when you've had a little sleep. Who are the Savurai? What does Savurai mean? What? Explaining, Svara. Explanatories, people. De Mefarshe, Perushe. They gave Perushim. De Mekarve Lahora. And they aren't Hora, but they are close to Hora. They're not the full deal, but they are close. And their job is to be Perushim. The Akrin, who we call these people Rabbanan Savurai, the Savurai rabbis. The Kol Maida Hava, Talivakai Perusha. Everything that was Talivakai, what was Talivakai? Hanging. Anything that was not yet decided, Perusha. They cleared it up. They sorted it out. They smoothed out the edges. And finally, at the end of them, if you look in this little quote number three, again from the Igeret, Ubatrei, and at the end of that, he says, Malach Rabbi Yossi, this is not Rabbi Yossi from the Gemara that you all mentioned, you see a later Rabbi Yossi, Ubiyomei, and in his day, Sopara, not only was the Sopara, the Istan Talmud, and the Talmud was finally finished. So there's a process. There's Ravina Ravashi, so hurrah, but that's not the end of the process. That's really the beginning of the end. It's like, you know, Churchill with the D-Day. You know what Churchill said, a D-Day? So it's not the end. It's not even the beginning of the end, but it is perhaps the end of the beginning. You know, it, you have to categorize things in that way. It doesn't matter. The Churchill will talk about it afterwards. The point here is that Ravina Ravashi were not the end, but they were the beginning of the end of this process. The end was after the Rabbanan Savorai. You ended up with the Talmud being finished. Now, I just want to refer very briefly to this piece from Rav Sri Ragon. You need to understand this, because this is a really important general source. This letter of Rav Sri Ragon, which I've brought you in English translation, because quite frankly the Aramaic would have been a lot of messing around, but with a lot of hard work.
How interesting.
It is interesting, and we have two versions of this letter, what we call the French version and the Spanish version. Very similar, but slightly different texts. This is from an English translation that I actually have in my house. And this is one of the first main works that we have on a description of the history of the oral law. The background to the oral law. So you need to know about this. It's called the Igeret of Rav Sri Ragon. Rav Sri Ragon was one of the last Gaonim. He lived right at the end of the period of the Gaonim. We're going to get to that in a minute, at the end of the sort of 900s. He was asked questions, well, how does the Talmud work? The Talmud was then a done deal. It was finished. It was a complete unit. And he was asked questions like, how did it come about? And why did the rabbis say things this way, that way, etc.? So he wrote this, if you like, introductory letter, the Sefer. It's a whole Sefer, really, about the background of the Gemara. And he says a few interesting things, and one of them I really want to pick up on. Have a look, please, look at this period where it says here, one second, as regards your question. You see where it says as regards your question at the top? I can't see a page number on it, but it says as regards your question at the top. You want to get that, girls? He says a few interesting things. First of all, he talks about the Savorayim, like we said before, and he says they add, if you like, the Peirush, the commentary, the back and forth, etc. He says, as regards your question, how were the Mishnah and the Talmud written? So he has a very interesting shita. He says, the Talmud and the Mishnah were not written. Throughout this whole period, we don't have a written Mishnah, we don't have a written Talmud. But were arranged, they were put together, and the rabbis were careful to study them orally, but not from written texts. And he quotes the Gemara in Tamura. Okay? It says, Dvarim Shebal Peh, Iyata Roshay La'omer Bitzav, Shinamah Ki Apiyah Dvarim Ha'ele Karti Yitcha Brit. Meaning that unlike the Rambam, this is a major machlokes, unlike the Rambam, who said that when the Mishnah was put together, it was written, and when the Gemara was put together, it was written, Rav Sri Ragon's understanding is that there was no written text at this stage, it was still an oral text. And that's very interesting because, of course, it would explain why we haven't got any historical text from this period. The first texts of the Gemara that we actually have manuscripts were from the 9th century. Okay? So he says the reason for that is because it really wasn't written down there. That's how you were thinking the Baal Peh. People remember them. And you have the Gemara, if you like, recited and memorized Baal Peh, which would account for the fact that there are sometimes slight differences in Girsa as to is it this Girsa, is it that Girsa, because the book was kept Baal Peh for a few hundred years. People used to know a lot. And by the way, you and I don't do much memorizing. But people who know how to memorize can memorize very well.
Yeah,
and not every person knew the whole Gemara. Some people had expertise. They had memorizers. What's that? They taught. For example, a Tana. The word Tana in the time of the Amorim means someone who had memorized hundreds and hundreds of writers who had Tanaitic material at their fingertips.
That's not a good system.
No, it's not. That's why they wrote it down.
Right, exactly.
Meaning, in other words, according to Rosh Hashanah gone, there
was... That's literally having those memorized, it's all gone.
Correct. According to Rosh Hashanah gone, there were three stages. There was completely oral, unsystematized oral law, which we talked about. Then there was ordered oral text, the Mishnah, the Gemara.
For how long?
About 300 years. And then by the 8th, 9th century, he makes a reference to something which later, or I'll refer to it later, which is the story of the four captives, which really at this point you end up with a written Gemara and a text, which we'll talk about in a little bit. Okay, fine. Now, Look at the piece from Rabbi Trivitz that I gave you.
Okay.
And yes.
If it's not written, then how do you expect the average Jew to keep halacha?
Oh, so we'll get to that in a minute. We'll get to that. That's one of the reasons.
Has it.
That could be one of the reasons, Sarah, why you saw coming from the Gaonim the beginning of halachic, if you like, summary books, like the art scroll equivalent of the time of the Gaonim. You have the Bahag and the Halacha Pesukos, because at the end of the day, the Talmud was an extremely intellectual, erudite process in the academies of Pumpadisa and Zura. The guy in the street house, you're going to get the Halacha from that. So you ended up with these other kind of shorthand Sforim, which we'll talk about in a minute. Rabbi Trivitz has a very interesting shita. By the way, you should read things by Rabbi Trivitz. He's got this website that I mentioned before, hashkafatsocial.com. And he has a whole shita here, which is very interesting. Interesting. First of all, he starts and he says, I'm going to flip around here, page 35. I've brought you extracts from the article, and I just want to, you should read the whole article, you can get it online, it's not hard to find, but I just want to bring you a few extracts from it. First of all, he says, what does it mean, hora? What does it mean that Ravina Ravashi soap hora? So if you look on the bottom of page 39, it says like this, the opinion of Rashi and the Rashbam, that the canonical give and take of our Talmud only commences with Rav Ashi and Ravina, appears to be universally assumed by earlier and later medieval authorities and commentators. Meaning, he understands like this, Rav Ashi and Ravina, hora means these were, if you like, statements. Hora are what's called apodictic. They are, do this, don't do that, do this, don't do that. These are the statements of halachic, law, halachic principle. All of the shakla vataria, the back and the forth, the questions, the stammer de Gemara. You know what I mean by the stammer de Gemara? The voice of the narrator asking all the questions. Who's asking all the questions in the Gemara? But what about this? But what about that? But how does that fit with this? And how does that fit with that? That voice is not the voice of Ravina Ravashi. That is the voice of the people who came after the Savarayim. Rav Shurigon, his famous epistle in which he chronicles the entire history of the oral law up until his own period of the Gaonika, quotes our passage about Matina continues. Afterwards, even though there were not any hara, there were interpretations and reasonings for a close to hara, and the rabbis are called Rabbanan Savorai. Okay? The French edition, which is usually accepted to be the most authoritative, asserts the beginning in the period after Ravina and Ravashi. Have you got the one with all the pages in it?
Oh, no.
You have?
No.
Hang on. Does everyone have the one with all the pages in it now? Make sure I've got the right one here. Yeah. Beginning in the period after Ravina Ravashi, the sages devoted themselves to interpretation and reasoning. The phrase close to Hora refers to the fact that the dialectical methodology of the Savarayic sages did not produce the same definitive halachic conclusions. They're not coming to halachas psukos. Nonetheless, it generated a dialogue which would serve as a basis on which future generations would formulate halachic conclusions. See how he's doing this. How does the Talmud work? What's the structure of the Talmud? You have the statements of the Amoraim. You have the discussion, the back and the forth, and the reasoning of the Savarayim. And based on that reasoning, you have the commentaries of the Rishonim. That's how it works. It's a very carefully structured system.
Wait, the
Amoraim are giving the basic legal principles. Rava and Ravina and Rav Huna and Rav Papa. But they're not arguing it all through. The Gemara, meaning, when I say the Gemara, it's interesting, when you say something like, the Gemara says, what does that mean? So they could be talking about a number of different things. You could be talking about Tanaim and Amoraim, or you could be talking about these Rabbeinu Savarai, who came afterwards, who really put a lot of the meat, the narration and the argument into the Gemara. What Rav Shura appears to be saying is that Rav Ashi concluded the period which produced a tradition of definitively worded legal decisions and interpretations, while the Savarayic sages produced a tradition of reasoning which seems to imply their decisions were expressed more as a discussion and as a dialogue. In fact, I read somewhere, where did I read this? There is an article, and when I was in America just now, and I never thought of this before, which is actually could be the origins of the two expressions, Gemara and Talmud. Meaning, the expression Gemara, as it's used in the Gemara, means more a tradition, a Masorah, something which is passed down. So Gemara, if you like, is the statements of the Amoraim. Talmud is an expression for the analysis and learning and back and forth, etc.
So
we use the two expressions.
Not in that, like, the Talmud.
Well, not really. Not the Tanaim. The Tanaim produced the Mishnahs and the Brisas. The Amoraim understand and analyze the Mishnahs and the Brisas and produce the ruling. And the Saburayim are producing the analysis.
The last one.
Oh, we're not still in the last one yet. But the Saburayim are the last ones, as far as we're concerned, in terms of the finished Gemara, the canon of the Gemara. Yeah.
When you say that they put in this dialogue,
yes.
Did they record dialogue?
No, it's not recorded. It's not recorded. It's synthetic. What do I mean by synthetic? You're not reading live feeds from the academies of Pumbedisa and Sura when you read the Gemara. Meaning, when it says, this rabbi said this, and this rabbi said this, and this one asked this, and this one said, what about this? So that is partly recorded discussions that went on, but it's partly structured arguments produced in the Gemara put into the mouths of the people. Meaning, you have rabbis arguing with each other in the Gemara that never met each other, that live hundreds and hundreds of years apart. That's because the Gemara wants to, maybe this was a famous argument that Rav Popper was known for this argument. But later on, Ravina, who never met Rav Popper, was known for this counter-argument, and therefore the Gemara structures those two as arguing with each other, but they weren't actually arguing with each other in real time. Therefore the Gemara, you know what I mean, by synthetic means it's put together, it's not made up, but it puts the principles together to produce this work which is meant to be definitive.
And when you have stories, like if you have like, you know, a rabbi talking to the Rish Lusa.
Yeah,
sure. Did the Amoraim put those stories in there? Or did the Saburayim put them in there?
I don't know.
Did they really ever know the Rish Lusa?
Yeah, for sure. For sure. In other words, stories about Rav Popper went to visit the Rish Lusa and they said they did and they did. I presume the stories are, they're not Midrashim. They knew the Rish Lusas. They weren't. There was a real, they had two major academies, Sura and Pumbedisa. They lived in Baghdad, okay? Later on they were in Baghdad, they lived in Babel. And the Reish Galusa, there was a lot of politics going on. And these were real communities in real time with real people. Now exactly how the story transpired as the Gemara presented is interesting. Because I presume when the Gemara was recording a story, it recorded the relevant details that we needed to know in order to understand the principles of Halacha. I mean, the Gemara is not just there to record like random stories. Rav Popper went to see the Reish Galusa and first of all they had, you know, duck sauce and a cream pate for breakfast, you know. Well, whatever it was, it's recorded in a way which is directed, but I assume a record of what happened.
Did they make up that story so we could learn about people matters, or did that story actually happen?
I don't know the answer to that question. I don't know the answer to that question. If something is phrased as a midrash, meaning it's coming off a pasuk, and it's creating a structure to explain an idea, then I think you can say that it's, it's a vehicle. It's a vehicle to express an idea. But when you're recording a story of this one meant that one and that one meant this one, like, I don't think you necessarily need to say that.
And the Amoraim also stories or the
Saburayim? Well, the Saburayim ultimately put them all together.
Okay.
Put everything together, yes.
Is there ever a time when somebody from before, like, responds to somebody that came later? Because it would make sense.
Yes, for sure.
Came later.
Yeah. Not made up. It's constructive, not made up. Made up implies it's random. Constructive implies.
So they came, but they came up with a dialogue.
Yes, the dialogue is quoted. Is constructed by the Saburayim.
So did the earlier people actually say what it
was? Those words? I don't know. But it's the essence of the arguments that's the point. Now, there were people that lived in the same time as each other. Some people were colleagues. You know, Robert and Abaya were colleagues and they had a back and forth and arguments the whole time. But occasionally you do see, you know, Rav Huna Amar Rav Papa, and then you look it up in the book and you see they lived, did he say this? The Gemara is using them, if you like, and putting those arguments. Maybe that was a very famous argument that Rav Popper was famous for, and this one was Rav Huna was famous for. But like we say that today, you know, if you think about it, you sit and listen to a rabbi give a shit, and you say, you know, the Shulchan Aruch says you should do this, but Rav Moshe Feinstein disagrees. He said, and you'll say, well, one second, the Shulchan Aruch lived in the 16th century, and Rav Moshe Feinstein lived in 1960. Like, how, you know,
that would be different than
the Shulchan Aruch disagrees with Moshe Feinstein. No, but sometimes you say things the other way around. You say, Rav Moshe Feinstein gives a heter to do this, but the Rav Akiva Eiger doesn't hold by that heter. Now, when I say that in those words, this is a discussion between halachic authorities. The fact that Rabbi Akiva Eiger disagrees with that heter, although Rabbi Akiva gave him 200 years before, yeah, means sometimes when we talk Torah, we have an ahistorical context. It's a discussion between shittas. It's not the people necessarily, and that's really what the Gemara is doing as well. Because it's not the people that are the same. It's not the people that matter. It's the shittas. Yes.
The arguments that constructed in the Gemara, why do they still kind of go off topic a lot?
What do you mean off topic?
Like, we're talking about one thing and then we'll write and go on a tangent to explain something else and then come back to it.
Okay, because that's proof of the fact that it's constructed in that sense, because it decides that now we're talking about that, let's talk about this and let's talk about this and let's talk about this. In other words, the Gemara wants to put together a whole lot of important information and direction on lots of different issues. It just has to decide where to put it. So sometimes it's linked conceptually. Now we're talking about this, then this is analogous. Sometimes it's linked by name. Now we've had this halacha of Rabbi Shua ben Levi. Let's talk about eight other things that Rabbi Shua ben Levi talked about. Sometimes it's like almost like a tangent, like you end up. And when it's, the Gemara is the last thing that this organizes, the opposite of the Gemara. The more you learn Gemara, the more you see how organized it is. Its structure is incredible. Incredible. And learning structure in the Gemara is the secret of how to learn Gemara. It only seems disorganized if you don't see the structure. Yes. Why? What question to ask? Did you never get one? Oh, you only got the one that's missing half the pages. Well, I'll give you one at the end because I don't think I've got any more, but I'll give you one later. But I've nearly finished that now and I want to talk about something else. Let's just look at the last, I think you've got this, the last paragraph where he puts in conclusion. You got that? To conclude. To conclude, he says, we see that the position of many medieval authorities was that although Rav Ashi redacted, this word redacted, he put together, okay, the Talmud, meaning to redact something means to take a body of information that came before and to, if you like, download it into a new system. He redacted the Gemara, the Talmud, in order to incorporate the statements of Amoraim within a constructed give and take. So Rav Ashi started this process. But this was not the end, it was the beginning of the end. His methodology was continued after him by redactors who came after him. As a consequence, the final redaction of the Gemara incorporated not only the statements of specific Amoraim, but also the canonical dialectics, meaning the back and forth which became a canon, which became fixed in the Gemara, which appear as anonymous give and takes. These replaced the halachas, psukas, terse rulings, interpretations of the Amoraim as a consequence of Rav Ashi's work and began the era of redaction which extended to the Savarim, etc. until its completion, which according to Rav Shurigon took place in the lifetime of Rav Yossi. Yes?
I have a question. I saw that there's only very few
like actual psaks in the Gemara. That's not true. The Gemara's whole purpose is psak. It doesn't often turn around and say, and the halacha is, drum roll, it doesn't often say that. You have to get the psak from the give and take. By the way, occasionally when it says v'hilchasa, we had this in our Gemara first semester, I remember that. V'hilchasa, when it says the halacha is, the understanding is they were often put in by the Savarim. Which is interesting. But 9 out of 10 times the Gemara doesn't say, and the halacha is, you have to work out from learning the sugyas and all the rest of the Gemara, which might have an impact on those sugyas, what the halacha is. Okay?
What year was the Gemara officially written down?
Well, written down, redacted, which are you asking? Because we're now saying they're different things. Rav Ashi and Ravina were living at the end of the 400s. The Savarim, we're talking about 500s, 600s. And then the final redaction, we're talking about 700s, 800s. 700s. Okay? End of the season. Have a look at my sheet now.
Written down.
Oh, no, written down? We haven't talked about it yet. We'll talk about that right now. Yes.
What you just said at the end of the
Yes. Yes. I think that's right. I think that's what he's saying. I think he's saying that what the Yerushalmi doesn't have, that the Bavli has, is much more of the dialectic. Meaning the Yerushalmi is more Gemara,
Right.
And Masorah, and the Bavli is much more of this discussive thing. And by the way, this is it's very interesting. And this is a fascinating topic. And I'll tell you who talks a lot about this. Rav Kook talks a lot about this and different methodologies of the Bavli, different methodologies of the Yerushalmi. I just picked up a book at the Sforim Sale in New York, which is very interesting, which deals with this whole issue. I started reading it on the plane last night, and hopefully we'll have some interesting insights by someone called Rav Bezalel Naor, who is a very, very interesting person. He's a big Rav Kook person writing in English. There aren't many, many of them. I also know his daughter. She's on campus in America. Anyway, that's not for now. But I wanted to look at my sheet, because for 10 minutes, I'm going to give you a little bit of historical overview, which will help you to put a lot of these things together. Let's just talk for a few minutes, look at a few maps. And you have to listen carefully, because I'm going to say this quite quickly. Just I want you to have this historical background. Are you all at a happy temperature? Is it warm, cold, just nice? Abby's on to it. Okay, now listen. I might have to draw my map of Europe on here again. Okay, fine. Let's go. First of all, go to page one. You haven't got it, right? But you're going to look at it. At the end of the class, please come up to me and tell me anyone who doesn't have anything, and I'll give them everything they need. Okay, but that's quite a big promise. Just from today, anything you need from last time or before has to be by email. And you can get everything you want, but it has to be by email. Now, what major works came out of the early Gaonim? So you need to be aware of these. And also you need to know where to find them in the library. Did anyone start with this thing with Rabbi Lerner, where he started taking around the base medrash upstairs? He did it with some of his groups. I don't think we did it with the Hilchos Shabbos group. Right, and I'm going to do that with my Hilchos Shabbos group as well. You need to know two things. You need to know what things are and where to find them. Okay? What things are, you can only get by learning what things are. Where to find them is either in book form or also online. There's an awful lot of stuff available online. And a lot of knowledge is not just knowing it, but knowing where you look for it. And therefore, this is very important. You need to fill in a lot of these gaps in your mind and understand this and really put this together. What do we have from the Gaonim? The Gaonim, again, the Gaonim starting from, let's say, 650 through to around 1000. Before 650, you've got the Savarayim. So again, get the years straight. Around 500 is the Rav Asher Ravina. Another 100 years or so of these Savarayim, putting everything finally together. And then you have the Gaonim. Now, what came out of the Gaonim? A number of works of halachic psak, which is interesting because it fits, like I think Sarah was saying before, that if everything really was oral, I don't think it was Sarah, it was someone was saying it before, if everything really was oral, like Rav Shura is saying, then it's, you know, how are people going to know what the halacha is? People aren't going to be able to remember the whole Gemara and analyze it. So you had a number of important works coming out of it. First of all, the Gaonim produced vast numbers of tshuvas. Responsa, which we have, by the way, we found a lot of these in the Cairo Geniza. I mentioned the Cairo Geniza before, right? In Egypt, in the Ben Ezra shul. I have mentioned the Cairo Geniza, I'm sure. The Cairo Geniza was a fascinating discovery. It was discovered by two little old ladies from England. I think they were nuns. And basically these manuscripts, which were very ancient, suddenly started appearing on the kind of manuscript scene in late 1800s in England and around. And Solomon Schechter, who was a very important scholar at the time in Cambridge, started saying, where are all these manuscripts coming from? And he traced them to these two little old ladies and worked out that what had been discovered was the Cairo Geniza, that in the Ben Ezra Shul in Cairo, which had been there for 1,000 years, there was a shul which had been closed up. And there was a Geniza. The Geniza is like Seamus, right? Except instead of having a box, they just had like a letter box. They had a mailbox in the wall. And an entire room behind it, which was their Geniza room. And every time anyone came up with something that was Hebrew that wasn't being used anymore, and they weren't quite sure what it was, they just posted in this thing and throw it in. And therefore, over a period of 800, 900 years, an entire pile of records and documents from that part of the world, from, let's say, the year 1100 all the way through to the 1800s, just built up. And they found that it's like a treasure trove And there was also, there was Sforim there, and there were Perushim there. But they were working drafts. They found the working drafts of the Rambam when he was working on the Mishnah Torah. His own working drafts where he crossed things out and said, ah, I'm not sure, maybe this, maybe Potter, maybe Chayiv, etc. They found marriage contracts which they'd reconstructed. Marital life. There were letters from people to other people. Debts. They found loan letters, loan documents. They found just general chit-chat documents. They found all sorts of stuff going on there, and part of the last 100 years is, and I don't think they've finished going through all the stuff yet.
Where is it all now?
What's that? Dr. Sheikh's working on the Cairo Geniza?
Yeah, she
translated. So speak to Dr. Sheikh about the Cairo Geniza. If you're interested in a good book on the Cairo Geniza, you can go on Google, not Google, Amazon, and you can buy a book called Sacred Trash. Sacred Trash. It's a fascinating paperback. It's only about 200 pages long. It's a, you know, a read over a long Shabbos. And it's really good. You basically know everything that I think an educated person, layman, needs to know about the Cairo Geniza. Obviously, if you're going to go do a PhD on the Cairo Geniza, you need to read more than this book. But I think in terms of your being generally educated people, that will be quite a good book. I must put together, I keep thinking about this, a good reading list on all these things.
Where is it now? In Israel?
Or it's all over the world. Bits and pieces here, Cambridge, other universities. I think Cambridge has got most of a lot. Ask Dr. Sheikh, she probably knows about it.
How did
it
get
them?
Was it,
They've been put online, and they've been copied by scholars, and they've been given over to be. So the Truth of the Goyim was one of the things we found there. Another very important book. Which book? Sacred Trash? Don't know. Just put it in Google, you'll find the guy immediately. The She'iltas, you need to know these, guys, you just remember these. The She'iltas of Rabbi Chaigon. Rabbi Chaigon was one of the early Goyim. He wrote a book called the She'ilta. What's She'ilta? It means She'ela. Question. It's just Aramaic. He basically goes through Parsha by Parsha. It's got nothing to do with, very little to do with the Parsha Teshuva. He has like a little piece, like a little drosha on the Parsha. And then he goes through all sorts of interesting halachas that relate to all sorts of stuff. And he just goes Parsha by Parsha, and he has a whole book of halacha. And the She'iltas was produced at that period as well. Of Rabbi Chaigon, very early gone. The halachas psukos of Rav Yehudai Gon, which again is just final halachic psak. And then finally in this list, the Bahag. The Bahag is very important because he's quoted a lot later by the Rambam, who disagrees with the Bahag a lot, by Rav Shimon Kayara, again living in this early period. He's the first one to put together a list of the Tariag Mitzvahs. And very controversial because he includes in the Tariag Mitzvahs all sorts of mitzvahs which are Darabonah. Now, we never had a class on this. I meant to have a class on this, and I don't think I'll have time for it this year. I don't know why this year felt shorter than last year. I don't know. Maybe it was a leap year last year. But I was gone more last year. I went away for 3 weeks last year. Basically, he puts together the Tariag Mitzvahs, but he has all sorts of inclusions, such as Megillah and saying Hallel, saying 100 brachas a day, etc., etc. Turn over the page, please. So that's the early Gaonim in terms of like an overview. Yes.
I think this is unrelated to the class in general, but how do we have 630 mitzvahs if we don't know what they are?
Well, that's an interesting question. There is a statement in the Gemara in Makkos that says, Torah tziva lanu Moshe, not Makkos. Where is it? Torah tziva lanu Moshe. Maybe it's in Brochus. I can't remember exactly. I should know that. Torah Tevelan and Moshe. The Moshe gave us Torah. Torah is Gematria 611. And the two mitzvahs that were given to us directly by God at Harsinai May 613. Therefore, we have a tradition from this. Dean, if you're leaving, can you get me some water, please? We have a tradition that there are 613 mitzvahs. Now, the Gemara does not enumerate which the mitzvahs were. But the Bahag and various people afterwards seek to try and identify in the Psukim, because if you go posik by posik, there are clearly more than 613 statements. Yeah. And you have to decide, first of all, which is a narrative statement, which is a command statement. Which is a command statement that counts as one of the 613, which is just a detail. And therefore, a number of people have different ways of counting them. It doesn't actually make that much of a difference, because everybody agrees that there are thousands of Doraisas. But not all of them make it into this list of 613 mitzvahs. There may be differences that halakhically that depend on whether you're in the 613 or not 613. The classic people to look at are the following. The Bahag is obviously the first one. The Rambam's Sefer HaMitzvahs, where he goes through the 613 and includes 14 introductory essays as to how he will count and won't count mitzvahs. Some of the most fascinating things called the Shorashim, Shorash Rish and Shorash Sheni, deal with what's the Raisa, what's the Rabbonon. This is an absolutely essential study in and of itself. And the Rambam Shita on that is not at all straightforward. The Ramban then comes back at him and defends the Bahag and has a whole argument. And the other one you need to know about, obviously, Sefer Chinuch, which is the one you probably know most about from high school days, who goes through as well, probably the easiest, most accessible one. But there's another one called Rav Sadigon, the Sefer HaMitzvot Rav Sadigon, which is literally 2 pages or 3 pages long. It's like a poem. He goes through the whole thing as a poem. But there's a commentary on that, which is about 3 volumes long. It's amazing. In terms of original to commentary, it's one of the biggest ratios, by someone called Rav Yeruchim Fishel Perlo, who lived about 100 years ago. And that is, has all, everything you ever wanted to know about the 613 mitzvahs, but were afraid to ask, that probably has it in. There's also a book I have at home called Tariag Mitzvahs, that talks about a lot of this stuff. I also have a class on it, Rabbi Katz has a class on it. And it may be, according to the Ramban, the final word is that actually aren't 613 mitzvahs at all. Anyway, that was a whole class potted into 2 minutes. Right. Let's have a look, please, at these maps, because I like maps. I found you some nice maps. Where was everybody at this time? So this is actually very interesting, during this period of the Ga'anim. This really is the period that the Jewish community starts to emigrate from Babel. Just get it clear in your mind. There was almost no one living in Eretz Yisrael in the time of the Amorim. They all basically left because they were under intense pressure by the Byzantines. Where did they go? They went to Babel. Babel became the center of the Jewish world. Well, they didn't just go to Babel. The truth is that some of them actually went to Italy. And one of the theories, although it's not definitely agreed on by everybody, is that it was the Italian Jews that really moved up and started the Ashkenazi community. Whereas the Jews from Babel, who eventually left Babel, they started the community which became the Sephardi community. Now, there's more to it than that, and people have done whole PhDs on this, I'm quite sure. But that makes a lot of sense, because if you think about it, the big things that happened in this period are as follows. Imagine this. The Roman Empire, have a look at this map of France at the top. So the Roman Empire covered everything. The Roman Empire covered, you know, France and Britain and what became a lot of work became Germany a lot later, and Italy, of course, and Greece, and the Middle East, and North Africa, etc. When the Romans left, everything fell apart. And it was fractured into millions of little tiny, you know, fiefdoms and kingships and people killing each other. This is what we call the Dark Ages, okay? The Arabs reunited that whole area of what we now call Sfarad, North Africa, Spain, the Middle East, all the people we call, quote-unquote, Sfaradim. And therefore, the Jews from Babel were able, once the Islamic revolution happened, were able to spread with the Islam all the way through those places. And therefore, if you look on page 3 for a second, thank you very much. Look on page 3, you see there's a map here, the Jews under Islam in the 7th and 8th century. You see that this is one very, very big empire, and there were Jews living all over, and they went from Babel. They went to Spain, they went to North Africa, they went to, you know, up into Iran, while they were there before anyway, and up into the Stans, into Kazakhstan, and into Azerbaijan, and into all of these places. And therefore you had an enormous Sephardi community, a very big Sephardi community living there. Although we call them Sephardi, but they're really the only ones in Spain were, and North Africa were Sephardi, but they get, you know, they have a lot of connections to each other. And then the Ashkenazi were living in this Frankish Empire, the Franks, who basically tried to make something of these little states over the 5th, 6th, 7th, 8th century. Charlemagne, you've heard of Charlemagne?
Yeah.
Charlemagne, the King of the Franks, Charles the Great, crowned on Christmas Day in the year 800 as the King of the Franks. So the way it worked is that the Franks gradually brought some order to the middle of Europe, and there was the beginning of what later became France. Okay, and the Jews, once the order came in, began to come into that as well, up from Italy. The Colonimus family, we'll talk about other people as well. So what you have by this, like the end of the Gaonic period, is you have these two very distinct communities. You have the Ashkenazi community living up in France, mid-France and Germany. You have the community living down in Spain and North Africa. You also have a very interesting community living in Provence. Where is Provence?
Oh, yeah.
The south of France, the south coast of France, was an extremely vibrant Jewish community, which was somewhere sort of mid between the Ashkenazim and the Sfarim. They had their own specific approach, but you have to understand how the world looked at that stage. But what was definitely clearly happening was gradually, but slowly but surely, the Babylonian Gaonate was losing power. And one of the classic stories, if you like, and maybe this is a historical term, maybe this is almost like a vehicle to describe it, is the story of the four captives. You heard the story of the four captives?
Yeah.
This is a famous story of the four captives. There were four Gaonim that were taken prisoner by pirates as they were sailing from Italy. This story is brought down later by one of the Rishonim, the Ravid. And they were captured and they were then sold off to individual places in Europe. One was taken to Spain, one was taken to North Africa, one was taken to Egypt, etc., etc. And these rabbis that ended up in these places became the founding fathers, if you like, of the major communities in these places. So that by the middle of towards the end of the Gaonic period, the Gaonim were losing control. You have, for example, people turning around and saying, they used to pay all their taxes to the Gaonim in Babel. So they stopped. They said, well, we have our own communities now. We have our own poskim now. They wrote to Rav Amram Gon and said, we need a siddur. We don't speak Aramaic. We speak Spanish, okay? What was that? We speak Spanish. We need to know how to daven. We don't speak Hebrew. We don't speak Aramaic. Please send us a siddur. Rav Amram Gon put together, if you like, the first major to the Jews of Spain, that's right. As to he wasn't from Spain, he was from Babel. But I'm saying, but they spoke Spanish. They spoke the what was left of Latin that turned into Spanish, that turned into French, etc. What's that?
Why did you
leave Babel? So they left Babel partly because there was persecution going on there, but partly because the lands were opened up by the Arabs. Meaning, if you live in Babel in the 8th century, there is now a trade route going all the way from Baghdad, all the way through North Africa, all the way to Cordoba in Spain. And you can follow that route. You couldn't do that in the 6th century. You get your head chopped off after 15 minutes on the road. But now you can because the Arabs are controlling it. And you can take your wares from wherever they are with your 100 camels and you can go to Cordoba and you can come back again with prizes from Spain and spices and whatever else they brought from wherever else they brought it. I suppose spices went the other way. But whatever else you buy in Spain, oranges. No, not oranges because they didn't have oranges then. Whatever. So you have, but that's why people started moving around. This was very, very important. I'll give you another example. They used to always have a Targum in Aramaic to the Sefer Torah when they leaned on Shabbos morning. They would read with a Targum. So the Jews, again of Spain, wrote to the Gaonim and said, well, what's the point of this? Why should we read it in Hebrew, which we don't really understand, and then translate it into Aramaic, which we understand even less? What is the point? We're going to stop this. We're just going to go and wrote back. Said, you can't stop this. This is the tradition, and this is the halakha. They said, yeah, but you know, we don't really need to listen to this anymore because we have our own people. So this idea of the founding of these communities is very, very critical, and this happened at this stage. This is also the point at which the Talmud was written. And this is one of the other things Rabbi Tribbett says elsewhere, is that when these communities now were living outside Babel, this is again the point that we had before, if the Talmud is said orally, like Rav Shuragon says, that works when you have the economies in Sura and Pumpadita. But when you now have a community in Spain, and a community in North Africa, and a community in Italy, and a community in, you know, somewhere else, Saudi Arabia, so you can't just have oral Talmuds wandering around. You have to have a written document. You have to have something.
How can someone in, like,
what do you mean? Why did you say they didn't know? First of all, people didn't know what was going on. It took, how long do you think it took to get a message from Baghdad to Cordoba?
How did they know that they were writing it on?
How did they know that it was a Talmud?
How did they know that they were, someone else could have written it?
Because then these things spread, because people took the Talmud around to these communities.
It was.
There was a Talmud, but these communities were now detached, so they had to have a lifeline, if you like, and that lifeline was a written Talmud. In fact, it says in the whole story of the four captives, it says the king, the non-Jewish caliph, or whatever, in Spain, said he wants them to write down a Talmud so that he can see what's in this new Talmud that everybody's talking about. It actually refers there pretty much for the first time, the writing down of the Talmud. And therefore, there's a lot of very interesting things going on. I want you to just look for a second at page number 4. I think there's something else which is going on at this time which is very important, which is these Arabs that are now running around the whole world are very intellectual.
They're rational.
They're rationalists. Well, there were different groups within the Arab world, in the Kalam, the Asharia, and the Mutalid. But what they're doing is they're writing a lot of stuff that was originally in Greek, and they're translating it into Arabic. And because of those translations, those Greek works are finding themselves in Jewish circles, which really never had access to them before. Meaning, when the Jews were Hellenized in the time of the Second Beis HaMikdash, and their first language was Greek, so they had access to all this stuff. But for the last 800 years, they'd had no access. They were speaking in Aramaic, they were living in Babel, etc. Now, for the first time in the late Gaonic period, the Jews now had access to the classics of Aristotle, Herodotus, and people like that. And that led to the whole Jewish rational school of the Rambam and the Ibn Ezra, and those people that we're going to talk about in terms of the Rishonim. That was another very important thing happening. So the Jews weren't living in a vacuum. They were existing, if you like, in the context of the Arab world. I'll give you another interesting piece of information. The Umayyads and the Abbasids, and I'm not getting into all the details. Remember we went around Yerushalayim before, we talked about the Umayyad palace? So the Umayyads had their capital in Damascus. But the Abbasids moved their capital to Baghdad. And that was a bit like going from Milwaukee to New York City. Nothing against Milwaukee. But like Damascus was a sleepy nowheresville. And Baghdad was a big cosmopolitan town. And therefore again it shifted, it made everything much more, if you like, vibrant, and the Jews much more into all of these things. There was also at this time the growth of the Karaites, which was a group of Jewish people who did not accept the Talmud and did not accept the rabbinic understanding of the tradition. And not just because it was written down, because there was a lot of interesting things that went on there. There was a whole political machlokas that the head of the person who founded the Karaites was overlooked to be the Reish Galusa, and he got upset and he broke away. The whole discussion there, but it also then it became a theological battle. It's often difficult to know which came first, which comes first, the theological or the politics. Meaning, people get upset. This happens in the modern day. People get upset. They, you know, the community splits in half because some guy gets overlooked for this. So he goes off and founds his own shul, and he says, "Well, if that's your attitude, I'm starting a conservative shul." So, what came first, the politics or the break from the theology? That's not always clear. The last thing I want to say before we finish is as follows. Just look for a second at page 4. I want to point out some important things. First of all, in this period of the Goyim, towards the later Goyim, there's the conversion of the Khazars, and there's a nice little map on page 5.
But Khazari is an island.
No, the Khazari is not an island.
No, I'm saying like, I thought
there was
the island of Khazar.
No, the Khazaria was a very large area, which is now like the north of Turkey, Uzbekistan, Azerbaijan, all of these places bordering on, on Afghanistan on the other side. All the stans, yeah? All where all the Bukharians come from. Bukharians come from Tashkent and all those areas around there. So the Khazars converted to Judaism. Later on, the Khuzari wrote the Book of the Khuzari based on, if you like, a fictional argument between the people in order to produce his, if you like, his philosophy work. But a few of the important things you need to know. First of all, you need to know the following on page 4. Rav Shriragon and Rav Haigon, very important goyim, okay, that came out of this later period. They were living at the end of the goyim period, and they both lived to a very old age. They were both pretty much 100 years old when they died. We've kind of skipped over a few of them, Rav Amram Gon, Rav Sadigon, Rav Amram Gon, we mentioned with the Siddur, but Rav Shurigon, Rav Haigon in Pumbedisa are very important. The death of Rav Haigon in 1038 is usually seen as being the end of the period of the Ga'inim. But there are some key figures that you need to know and key Torah works from this later period as well. I'm doing this quite fast, but I've got 1 minute left, and let's just finish with this. Look at number 5, page 5 and 6. I want you to read this at some stage yourself. The key Torah figures, as I said at the end in Babel, were of Shurigon and of Haigon. In Spain, this was the golden age, quote unquote, of Spanish Jewry. The Spanish Jews were running Spain pretty much. People like Chisda ibn Shaprut, who was a major author and scholar there. Shmuel Hanagin, who was basically the prime minister of Spain. Donash ibn Labrat, who composed loads of poems, including ones we sing on a regular basis, like D'Roi Yikra, etc. So if you want to pick a nice name for your child and you want to impress your parents, you could always call your little boy Donash, or you can call him Lab Rat, which I think probably has lost a little bit in the 1,000 years in terms of being a cool name, but nevertheless, I'm sure at the time was definitely something to be called. Rabbeinu Bachya, who wrote the Chodesh HaVavos from this period as well. In North Africa, I've brought you Rabbeinu Nissim, who is not the Rabbeinu Nissim on the Rif, another one, Rabbeinu Hananel, which is quoted a lot by Tosfos. France and Germany, this is the period of Rabbeinu Gershom, and the beginning of he's the famous one that had all the different cherems of Rabbeinu Gershom, not to marry two wives, and all sorts of other things like that, and various other people. You just need to be aware, just turn to page 6 and we'll finish with this, there are a bunch of very important major works of Jewish thinking that came out of this late Gaonic period, and you just need to be aware of them. The Igeres of Rav Shirugon that we talked about before on the Oral Law, the Mavoa Talmud of Rav Shmuel Anagi, which is a whole methodology to learning Talmud, that's printed in a standard Gemara Brachas and the Vilna Shas at the end. Emunas Vadeus of Rav Sadigon, a classic work of Hashkofa, when Hashkofa meant more than just are you Haredi or modern Orthodox. You know, real Hashkofa, Emunas Vadeus, understanding these ideas. Chodes Halvavas, which I said before, based on the Emunas Vadeus of Rabbeinu Bachya, and of course all the works of Rabbeinu Gershom, which Rashi was very much based on as well. So even though this is not the most fertile period, you can see, like, we've covered a lot in these 400 years, a lot does happen, but what you need to move to, and this is where we can pick up next time on Sunday, Be'ezrat Hashem, is by the beginning of the 11th century, where the Rishonim start, we've moved from a centralized Jewish community in Babel to Jews all over the world. Europe, North Africa, Spain, Babel, in a span of 500 years. And then we pick it up, really, because the Rishonim is really where it all begins for us in terms of halacha and the process of Pesach, which we'll deal with next time, Be'ezrat Hashem. I'm sorry there were a lot.